Michael Nicholson, Reel 30, did that cause much of an impact, his death?
You mean in the situation
of the war? You know, was it a very depressing moment?
No. I mean, for us there? No.
Yes.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, one expected casualties. One didn't expect the commander to be up there. People criticised him in retrospect that a commanding officer should never be in the front line. I mean, he's supposed to be at the back line commanding operations. But he realised that unless momentum could be created again, you know, they might lose. I mean, a few days later, I was sharing a bottle of whiskey in a crofter's hut in the middle of nowhere with some paras who had fought with him and saw him die. One said that Colonel H was a nutter. The other said he had no choice. I mean, that was the kind of divided opinion. The fact is that his action led to victory. And he got a VC for it. No, at the time it didn't depress us because, you know, a lot of people were dying and Colonel H was just another commanding officer as far as we were concerned.
Did you attend the burials?
We did attend the burials. 15, I think, paras were buried at once, including Colonel H. It was an astonishing sight. Must remember that I was reporting, of all the 16 wars that I've reported, this was the only one in which I was reporting the fighting of my own men, my own people, my own countrymen. And so it was a particular, it is, you know, it, my father was in the army. I grew up some of my early years surrounded by the army, so maybe that had some impact on me too. But I remember that morning, it was a drizzly, dirty, cold morning, a perfect morning for funerals. And there was just an open pit, long pit, already filled with water. And they laid out the body bags, black body bags in a line. The paras were all surrounding, you know, water dripping down their faces. I remember Rick Jolly went forward and actually poured a body bag into line. It was slightly out of line, so he wanted to make it neat. Service was held, a few words were said. But the most impact on us was that there was a Royal Marine bomb disposal expert called Bernie. Bernie used to write poems. He had a new poem every day for us. He came from Cornwall, typical Cornishman, red beard. He played the fiddle. And he stood on the hill just behind us. And he played a dirge on his fiddle. A wonderful, wonderful scene that I'll never forget. The sound of the fiddle, the violin, and the soft murmuring of the prayers, and these body bags slowly being covered by water.
Would you have filmed any of the burials?
Yes, we filmed it. We filmed it. Yes, they allowed us to film that. Lots of things they didn't allow us to film. We're moving forward now towards the end, aren't we? The last few days, we were, the commanding officers and the senior NCOs were called into a briefing by Jeremy Moore. Tony Wilson, Brigadier Tony Wilson, who, a very, very gung-ho guy who got into an awful lot of trouble because he moved his paras too far ahead that in fact he was held responsible in a way for what happened on Sir Galahad because he jumped his paras too far ahead without any backup. But you know, it was a decision a man had to take and he took it. And he was disgraced, I think, because of it. Most unfairly, I think. But he wanted us to stay for the briefing by Jeremy. We ought to know what was going on. I mean, we were in it too. But Moore said no. Or maybe it was Julian Thompson said no, I forget. But we weren't allowed to know what the offensive, the next plan was for the final offensive on Port Stanley. We were allocated to go with the Gurkhas up on Mount William. I think our last night of the war, our last day of the war, we watched 105 field guns pounding Port Stanley, pounding the positions around Port Stanley, rather. They actually did hit Port Stanley a few times because that's where the Argentinians had put their biggest guns, and Falkland Islanders were killed as a consequence. But most of the pounding was going on around the on the hills around. And we watched that during the day. Then we marched further up the mountain with the Gurkhas and had some artillery cut. We had some incoming there. And that night, we watched what turned out to be the final night of the war. Fighting was going on Tumbledown and Mount Harriet, just below us, each side of us. We had a kind of bird's eye view of it. We were perfectly safe because nothing was coming in. It was pitch black, of course, freezing cold, snowing. Bernard, who was 10 years older than me then, we had our big heavy coats on, but he took his coat off and wrapped it around the camera. I always remember this. And we said, "What on earth are you doing? You'll freeze." He said, "Well, it's better that I freeze than the camera freezes, because if the camera doesn't work, there's no point in me being here." That was the way he worked, the way he thought. So there he was, shivering, crouching over his camera. Brian and I were just lying on the top, if you could imagine, the top of the escarpment. And we were on the edge of it, looking down either side of Mount Harriet and Tumbledown. We had a fantastic view. And I did. Do you want to wait for this to go over, this aircraft? Yes, we had this, Brian and I had this wonderful view. And I had a very old tape recorder. You know, I went to the Falklands without a tape recorder. And I had to buy one for £20 from a naval rating. The oldest tape recorder I think I've ever... I've still got it somewhere. Funny old thing. But it worked. And so I thought I'd do a kind of Richard Dimbleby thing, you know. Here I am on the top of the mountain overlooking Mount Tabadan and William, and I can see evidence of fighting below me, the machine gun fire, the traces, the explosions as grenades go off. Here and there, here there's a flare. The Argentinians have set up a flare to see if they can locate the British forces. They're trying to shoot out the flare. Well, the kind of things that I remember in Vietnam, exactly the same kind of same situation. And of course, what we couldn't see down below was real hand-to-hand fighting. I mean, bayonet fighting. There were bayonets are being used. Knives are being used. It was that close. And of course, by the morning, the Argentinians had been defeated on both those mountains. And it was our then turn to start moving forward with the Gurkhas, which we did. There was occasional fire. There was occasional fire, but not a lot.
And would you have been wearing flak jackets then? Would you have been protected?
Yes, we had flak jackets. It's the only occasion other than in Vietnam when I've worn a flak jacket. Didn't have helmets there. We weren't wearing helmets for some reason. So we were on our way with the Gurkhas, and by that time, of course, we could see Port Stanley from where we were on Mount William. Just in the distance, about 5 miles away, 6 miles away. And suddenly, a major came out of his bunker and said, "There's a white flag flying over Stanley. Bloody marvellous." Yeah. Of course, we didn't film it because, you know, we weren't prepared for it. So we said, "Mike, please go back down again and do it again." So with the camera running, he came up, but he mucked it up. So he went back there, took about 4 times, but eventually he came out and said, "There's a white flag flying over Stanley, bloody marvellous," he said. And of course the Gurkhas were very disappointed. Very, very disappointed, because, you know, they hadn't had a fight. It was their turn, you see, then to start moving forward, and they would have been the most forward unit, so we'd have actually seen some great fighting, we'd have actually been in on it. But we were disappointed too, I suppose, to think that we'd missed out on the last fight. We could suddenly see little dots running down the mountains away from us, down towards Port Stanley. And they were the Argentinians retreating, surrendering, and running off. And that's how we saw the ending of the war. I then hitched a lift back to where I knew Jeremy Moore was, just in time to see him getting aboard a helicopter to go to accept the surrender in Port Stanley. And I said, can we come with you? He said, no, no, no. I said, but, you know, we want to film the surrender. No, 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 no. I'm going on my own. And here's the man who said that he wanted his son to see how his father fought the war. Do you know, that surrender was not filmed or recorded by anybody. He even refused to allow a Royal Navy official photographer to film the signing of the surrender in case, can you believe it, in case it upset General Menendez. Can you imagine, had we lost and we were surrendering, you wouldn't be able to move for Argentinian camera crews. And yet Moore, cowardly, I think, yes, I say that deliberately, flinched at the last minute, and I don't know, a man of just didn't seem to have the confidence that one expected from a general. Disappointing man, I think. But anyway, maybe I'm just sour grapes for me, but you know, I think it ought to have been recorded for our probably our only war this century, I hope to God, not to have had the surrender recorded. Anyway, I then jumped into a helicopter, leaving Brian behind, and rushed back to, I mean, you literally hitch lifts with helicopters. In fact, on this helicopter, I remember that, it's coming back to me, in order to give me a seat, because I was by the, you know, pretty well known by the troops there, the crewman actually hung on to the skid outside in order to give me a seat in the helicopter. So we hobbled back to San Carlos. And again, here's a bit of Rambo, Sylvester Stallone. I get back then across the only Marisat ship, RFA, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary ship with a Marisat telephone, was Norland. But she's anchored out, I can't get to her. But then I see a little dinghy with an outboard motor, an army dinghy with an outboard motor. So I get it and it starts, and I go out to the ship. And I climb up the rope ladder up the side of this ship, you know, dangerous thing to do. But, you know, I'm exhilarated. I've seen, you know, I know the war is ended. And I'm going to break the news to everybody. What, you know, I could have flown over that ship. Get aboard. Go to the radio room. Sorry, there's a blanket veto on everything. You can't broadcast. Why? MOD orders. You can't broadcast. Up turns Kim Sabido for IRN, and up turns Max Hastings for the Evening Standard. We've all got our scoops. Well, news at 10 is only about half an hour away. Can you imagine me going live onto News at 10, telling the world that there's a white flag over Stanley and General Moore has just gone to sign the surrender document? Yeah. And they said, you can't say it, you can't do it. So there were the three of us, absolutely devastated. And he opened a bottle of whiskey and the three of us finished it. Next morning, of course, we were allowed to broadcast the fact, because by then Maggie Thatcher had told the House of Commons. And it's been said that, that she put a blanket no so that she could announce it, and it did not be announced by, you know, us. I can see why she did it, but you can imagine how disappointed we were. I read a great piece. I mean, it was another long piece, 13 minutes long, that we broadcast. But nevertheless, there you are, the war was over. And for me, that seemed to be the end of the line. I mean, there was lots of mopping up to do, but Max did this famous walk into Port Stanley. You know, he was a territorial para. He was I think he had a commission in the TA. And so he put on his, and a lot of the time he wore his uniform, which was a bit naughty of him, which was why he got to so many places that we couldn't get to. People thought he was a member of the Army Press Office. But he suddenly gets to Port Stanley, the race course, where all the paras are waiting for the order to go in. And it was all very quiet, and he thought, well, I think I'll just walk down and see what's happening. So he actually just walked down into Port Stanley and was the first Englishman into Port Stanley. God bless him. we then, as I said, did the mopping up, and we were astonished at the mess. I mean, an army of occupation. It had no discipline whatsoever. The streets were full of human excrement. They used the post office itself as a lavatory. I mean, it was an absolute disgrace mess. It looked as if the war had been fought in Port Stanley. It was disgusting. They'd set fire to certain things. We watched the handover of weapons as they queued up to hand over their weapons, and then as they were sent aboard the boat to be sent back to the prisoner of war ship that would then take them home. And I think I did my... Oh, yes, we flew across to the West Falklands to witness the surrender there. But all in all, you know, it was very anticlimactic. It's, I suppose, the end of war, most wars are. I remember my last piece to camera, and I must read it to you, I think, because it's a long time ago. Yes, I can remember the last piece to camera I did as we were waiting to leave, and we had to wait 10 days, I think, before the first Hercules came in to take us home. I stood in front of all the departing Argentinian troops. There was a huge pile of weapons behind me. It was a dirty, grey, drizzly day, and there was smoke from a fire drifting across. I can remember it so well. And I said that you know back home how bloody this war has been. We have witnessed a very bloody war. So maybe all I need to do is to remind you of the words of the surrender document, that these islands are now back in the hands of those they belong to. Michael Nicholson, News at 10, on the Falkland Islands. So that was the end of the story for me. But it was almost the end of the story for Max Hastings, too, because, you know, one of the strange things about the Falklands War, and I've never been able to explain it, and nor does anybody else, but the camaraderie that normally exists between journalists in a war situation did not exist in the Falklands. And I don't know why. Elsewhere, whenever you get a load of British journalists together, there is camaraderie. You help each other, you know, you kip with each other and eat with each other and you swap information. But it didn't happen there. And I remember saying, I remember hearing somebody say in the Upland Goose was where we were staying. It was the bar and where we were. No light there, of course, but the candles at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Didn't get light till 10, and got dark at 4, so it wasn't much daylight. But I remember somebody saying, you know, when all this is over and we're home, we must all get together. And Patrick Bishop said, I don't think we will, you know. And we never did. It was most odd, most odd. And I remember the last night in the Upland Goose, we all got a bit drunk, as you can imagine. And Max came in for a lot of stick. A lot of people blame Max for their own failures. As I told you earlier, Max worked terribly hard. He used his position. I mean, he was a friend of Commodore Clapp, who was the Commodore on board Fearless. And while the rest of us were, you know, sleeping on the floor in sleeping bags, smelling of diesel, Max slept in the day cabin, the Commodore's day cabin, you know. He was invited to various places that none of us were invited because of his position. You know, he was something of a minor aristocrat from a famous father and famous mother. It helped him, which upset an awful lot of people. Plus the fact, you know, he had this kind of drawling upper class slang which irritated especially the Scots. But you know, I reminded people then, and I remind people today, you know, if I had those connections, I'd have used them the same way. And when it all is said and done, you know, he was a damn good journalist, and a few better, and he took as many risks as anybody else. But that last night, people were blaming him
some of them even said that he'd sabotaged some of their stories, that actually had taken them off the telex machine or destroyed them or dropped them in the river, in the water. None of which, of course, is true. One little Scot from, I think, the Glasgow Herald, irritated beyond words by this tall, gangling toff, suddenly lunged at him with a bayonet. They started to collect souvenirs, and this was an Argentine. And she lunged at him. And he was grabbed by, I think, a guy called Derek Hudson of the Yorkshire Post, who kind of put a neck lock on him and held him back, literally within inches of Max's throat, who didn't move at all, stood there, nonchalantly holding his whiskey. And I remember Hudson saying, "This isn't the time or place to kill Max Hastings." And I thought, you know, having survived all the bombs and bullets of the months of the Falklands War, I'm damned if I'm going to die at the hands of a fellow hack. I thought it was time to go home.
Was this a very different war for you, though? You said earlier it was your war. You know, this was.
It was the first time I'd fought alongside British troops. And, of course, to begin with, we started to say our troops, our aircraft, our pilots, our ships. And I was reprimanded by my editor that one must be more objective, and it's the British troops and the British government. And, you know, even recently, I'm talking in the year 2002, 20 years on, I went back to the Falklands to do a commemorative piece on the anniversary of the landing. And I visited all the various graveyards, and there are many, and all the memorials, there are many. And I wanted to remind viewers of the events. I mean, more than half our viewers would not have been alive during the Falklands War. Only the other day I gave a little talk in one of our schools here. You know, the average age of the guys, the sixth formers, are 16, 17. You know, they weren't alive in the Falklands War. This is old history to them. It's as historic as Waterloo. So I wanted to remind viewers of the events, and I went through the events very briefly for television, and I talked about, you know, our losses, our troops. And the editor even now went apoplectic about it. You know, you mustn't talk about our... But, you know, that's the feeling I had, and we all had, I think, until we were told not to do it, that this is our war. And I must say, one became very understandably less objective because you were fighting alongside your Yorkshireman, your Cockney, your Scot, your Welshman, you know, our people, my people. But to talk them to talk about as if they weren't, as if they were a third remove, was very difficult. And I suppose that one of the reasons why my reports perhaps hit the chord was because I was determined to be more subjective than I was supposed to be allowed to. I've never understood why we are supposed to be absent of humanity because we haven't been journalists. They were my people, and I saw them die. So it was understandable that I was more inclined to talk about our men, my war. It's the first time I've been to war with my people, and I trust to God it's the last.